I will be talking about how jets shine, and there will be two parts to my talk. The first part will be how jets shine close to the black hole, and the second part is how they shine far away from the black hole. And starting with close in, I'm perfectly set up for my talk by the previous talks in this session and earlier in the day and yesterday. And there are two pieces that motivate my presentation. The first piece is that emission M87 extends down to very small distances, just around 10 gravitational radii. The second piece that is quite exciting is that Avery's modeling suggests that in order to get good match with observations, he needs to put radiating particles just at about the same distance. So it seems that something special might be happening just around the distance. And what's interesting is that we expect the so-called stagnation surface, which I show with the magenta line on the schematics, happens to lie just around the same distance. What's the stagnation surface? Marcel already talked about this earlier. This is a surface, if we were to put a piece of plasma on a field line that threads the rotating black hole, then this piece of plasma will not know whether to fall in under the action of the force of gravity or fly out under the action of the centrifugal force. These two forces are balanced. They balance each other out at the surface. So the material that is the gas that's inside the stagnation surface will fall into the black hole. The material that's outside will fly out. And the density of material at the surface will go down to zero over time because mass runs away in both directions. So we will eventually end up with near zero density. We will have not enough charge to screen the electric field parallel to the magnetic field, and we will get what people study in pulsars, the polar cap gap, where uncompensated electric field accelerates particles to large energies. So it sounds like this could be something that is worth looking into in the context of black holes. And this is where I zoom in on a patch of a stagnation surface where we have uncompensated electric field that is parallel to the large-scale magnetic field. And I ask, what will happen if we put an electron inside of that gap? Well, this electric field will accelerate this electron to large energy. You can compute this energy for M87. The Lorentz factor with which the electron will fly out is huge. It's about 10 to the 9. This electron will then be free to fly along the magnetic field because eventually the plasma screens out the charges. There is no electric field outside, so this electron just flies out. What does it see? Well, it sees the submillimeter emission that the EHT detects, it will interact with those cold radio photons. It will Compton upscatter them to gamma ray energies. And these gamma ray photons, they also not propagate in vacuum. They see the same seed photons and they can pair produce on them. So from one initial electron, we get the same electron with lower energy plus a pair, which was produced by the gamma-gamma interactions. So at every step of the way, we go from 1 to 3 electrons to 9, and then to more and more and more electrons, so we have a runaway. And how long will this last? Well, it will last so long as the daughter electrons and positrons that are produced in this process are energetic enough to pair produce. The gamma rays that are not energetic to pair produce on the background radiation, these gamma rays that are shown in the green, medium energy, will fly out and be detectable in principle by us. Eventually, the process in this cascade saturates at a multiplicity of about 1,000. So for every initial electron, we end up with about 1,000 electrons and positrons overall. How large is this gap in the magnetosphere, in the jet? It turns out that for M87, it's really, really, really tiny. It's microscopic compared to the scales that we can resolve in the global MHD simulations. It's just about 10 to the minus 5 gravitational radii. And this leads to a very healthy cascade that I just described. In contrast, for Sagittarius A star, the luminosity is much lower. and there is no cascade. So this is potentially quite interesting because we do see the jet in M87, but we don't quite see it in Sagittarius A star. So maybe that's because we don't have this cascade that powers the electrons that they can radiate. We can look more quantitatively at what kind of emission we expect, both in the radio and in the high energy emission. And here I show two panels. In the right panel, I show the electron and positron energy distributions. So it's E squared dNdE. And along the horizontal axis is the energy. It's about Lorentz factor of 10 to the 3 on the right, and Lorentz factor of about 10 to the 10 on the, on the left is 10 to the 3, and on the right is 10 to the 10. And for gamma rays that will be able to escape the system, the left boundary is 10 to the minus 3 giga electron volts, or 1 MeV. And on the right, it's about 1,000 giga electron volts. So we're starting with one single electron at a Lorentz factor of about 10 to the 9. And we are letting this electron collide with the ambient radiation. And so what we're going to get, as I showed in the previous plot, we're going to create an electron-positron pair at an energy of about half of the original electron energy. And the electron itself will decelerate into this energy distribution, which looks like a power law here. We can continue our cascade simulation following generation after generation. And what we're seeing is that the electron distribution is cooling down. And there are gamma rays which are produced that are not energetic enough to pair produce on the ambient submillimeter photons. And they escape. So we see a flat spectrum in gamma rays that is, in principle, observable if we happen to be directly along the line of sight of the, directly along the jet axis. So what are the consequences of this cascade? We find that for M87 parameters, the power of the gamma ray emission that is tightly beamed along the jet axis is around 10 to the 43 ergs per second, or about 10% of the total jet power inferred by the measurements of power of the cavities that the jet inflated on large scales. The radio emission is a small fraction of that. It's about 10 to the 41 ergs per second. But if you account for the fact that it's somewhat beamed toward us, then we will see what we will see actually will be higher. It will be consistent with the submillimeter, with the level of submillimeter emission that we detect. So that's quite interesting. We might not even need to have seed photons produced by the disk. It's possible that the jet feeds off the photons that it itself produces, and so both the radio and the very high energy emission that the jet in M87 produces could be all produced by one single process of particle acceleration at the stagnation surface. As I also mentioned, in Sagittarius A star, the luminosity is much lower, and the gap is too wide for the cascade to operate. Let me give you an idea of how the stagnation surface looks like in a simulation of accretion disk. Here I show a vertical slice through a simulation that's already well developed. This is a black hole at the center. The disk is fallen into it. It's dragging the magnetic fields into the black hole, and it's about 30 gravitational radii on the side. We also can take a look at the meat of the disk. This is a horizontal slice through the same simulation. So you see the disk is counter-rotating, and the black hole here is also counter-rotating. The spin here of the black hole is 0.9. The colors show density of the disk, logarithmic scale. Red is high, blue, yellowish is low. And of course, the stagnation surface here is shown in a magenta line. So what is interesting is that on rather short time scales, the stagnation surface is highly variable, and the magnetic field is also shaking around on rather small scales. So it's conceivable that from time to time, we see a patch of the jet that's pointing toward us and is producing the high energy emission, which can lead to flares and associated increase in the radio emission as well, just as we heard in the previous talk. So let me shift the gears and go on to the next item on the agenda. And the emission, it is the emission from large scales of the jets. As AGN jets interact with the ambient medium, then we see the emission. The question is, how can we understand that interaction? And for this, clearly, we would like to run some numerical simulations. So let me show you two such simulations where I take a very simple model for the ambient medium. It's just a simple power law density profile. And just to make it really, really, really simple, I would like to start from scratch. I will put a perfectly conducting spinning sphere in the middle that I threaded with monopolar field. All I need is energy injection in the center. And let me consider two cases, high power case and low power case. So let's consider the high power case first. Let's spin the sphere. We see that there is a magnetic field line that I follow that expands. It's like a drill that tries to push through the ambient medium. And what you can see is quite interesting, that the jet that develops, first of all, is very well collimated. It's almost cylindrical. And it's wobbling quite erratically side to side. So it seems like the head of the jet has some kind of instability attached to it. But the rest of the body of the jet seems to be very stable. Let us decrease the power by about a factor of 100 and see how that affects the large-scale jet morphology. The same exact settings, except the magnetic field strength went down by a factor of 10. So the power went down by a factor of 100. You see here the situation is quite different. The jet is quite a bit wimpier. It's not so readily punching through the ambient medium. The scale of this figure is actually much smaller, so I'm zooming in. This jet is much less extended than the high power one. And you can see that the plumes that are produced are kind of staying in front of the jet rather than flowing backwards. So you can see that there is quite a big change in jet morphology just due to the change, simple change in jet power. So how does the jet morphology depend on the power? Well, this is high power, medium power, 10 times lower, and even lower by another factor of 10. And when I made these plots for my computational type proposal, that was due, of course, at an inconvenient time, at about 3 a.m., I was forced to put these guys together side by side. And I got stunned because I immediately saw that this guy looked like M87 and this guy looked like Cygnus A. So it seems like what I inadvertently did, I potentially reproduced the transition between FR1 and FR2 morphologies in AGN. So I would be very interested if people have comments on this, and happy to discuss this later. So here are my conclusions. First of all, the first part of the talk is that emission that's coming close in from the black hole can be nicely described as coming from the vacuum-like gap or stagnation surface that is located just around where the emission seems to be coming from, around 10 gravitational radii. In M87, the gap is working really well. It's really healthy, really sharp, and is able to account for the energetics of both radio and gamma ray emission from M87. In Sagittarius A star, on the other hand, the gap doesn't quite work. There is too low ambient emission for the gap to operate. So maybe this difference explains, if the emission mechanism is what we propose, why Sagittarius A star jet is not easily seen. In the second half of the talk, I discussed the potential cause for the FR1-FR2 dichotomy in the jets. Some of the jets are centrally dominated in their emission, and others are dominated by the lobes, which makes the dichotomy. And it seems like just a simple change in jet power can explain that. Apparently, I'm very quick on stage, and I have a few backup slides that I can go over. I still have about 7 minutes, do I? Great. So I wanted to highlight another interesting result that my collaborators and I recently found. And namely, we tried to constrain the field strengths in the jets of active galactic nuclei, and therefore the field strengths that thread the horizons of the supermassive black holes. And the idea here is really simple. We can measure, if we can measure field strength threading a jet at some distance, we can multiply it by the area, and that gives us the magnetic flux through the black hole. If we see the luminosity from the accretion disk, we can then compute the mass accretion rate, and we can probe the disk jet connection observationally, because we know both the magnetic field strength and the mass accretion rate. And this is what the simulations tell us, how they connect. So we can compare the simulations against the observations. How can you measure the field strength in the jet? We can use the so-called core shift method. The radio core is where the jet becomes optically thin to its own synchrotron emission. This is where the optical depth is of order unity. And this core position depends not only on the frequency of observation, but also on the field strength. So from the displacement of the core between the two frequencies, you can back out what the field strength is at the position of the core. Then you multiply that field strength by the area of the jet, you got the flux. That's what we did for a sample of about five dozen of radio-loud galaxies. Along the vertical axis are plotted the observationally inferred magnetic fluxes through the jets. And along the horizontal axis, we plot what we would expect those fluxes to be if the accretion was happening in the mad state, which John and others discussed earlier. That is, when the black hole has been stuffed with as much magnetic flux as possible. And what we found is that there is a really good agreement between the observational points and the dashed line, which is the prediction of the simulations. What's interesting here is that M87 actually is sitting quite a bit above of this correlation, which means that it should be more mad than mad. But it turns out it's actually really good, because in order to make this plot, we had to assume that the disks were relatively efficient. We just assumed one single efficiency of 40%. So for M87, it's probably of order of 1%. So this point will actually is going to travel horizontally by about two orders of magnitude, and it will land precisely on the correlation. So this suggests that potentially the accretion flow around M87 is in the magnetically arrested disk state. So that's all of what I wanted to present. Thank you very much.
Can you repeat again, what they actually do is this Panarov Riley 1 and 2 division simulations?
The numerical setup?
Yeah.
You're asking what the numerical setup is? Let me rewind back.
And at the same time, could you comment on what do you mean by powerful and low power and high power? What do you compare with what?
Here, let me go step by step. So the first question was, what is the setup? And what is the density scaling? So we take a single power law density distribution. So the density rho as a function of radius is rho 0 times r to the minus, in this case, 2.5. These simulations were originally meant to simulate core collapse gamma ray bursts. That's why we chose this steep scaling. In reality, the scaling for active galactic nuclei will be probably flatter.
Density and pressure?
This is a great question. So here we consider no gravity. Therefore, in order for the entire structure to stay put, we cannot give it any thermal pressure, otherwise it will fly out. So you will ask me, how come my jets are collimated by something that doesn't have any pressure? Well, that's because once the jet starts to propagate, it runs at essentially the speed of light into the ambient medium. It shocks the ambient medium to the virial, in a sense, temperature. That is what collimates the jet. So it's really in these kinds of things, when the jet is supersonic, the ambient pressure is not really important. What's important is what the REM pressure of the jet is, and the ambient medium adjusts to that because of the shock. Does that answer your question?
The power of the jet.
Right. So the power of the jets, in the case of core collapse jets, this corresponds to 10 to the 15 Gauss on the surface, if this were a magnetar inside of a star. In case of AGN, this corresponds to a power of about Cygnus A, what you have in Cygnus A. This guy will be 1% of Cygnus A.
We have just the power law in the external atmosphere. And
what gives you a scale of power?
Well, I do what you do in your recent paper. You assume that this magnetar is actually not right next to the ambient medium. There are five orders of magnitude that I don't include here for simplicity. As I said, this is a zeroth order simulation. You have a jet, like an M87, that collimates all the way up to Bondi radius, where it doesn't really interact with the ambient medium. So I know if I start with a certain field strength on the surface, what the field strength will be at the distance of the Bondi radius where the jet starts to interact with the ambient medium. And that's what sets my normalization. We can go over the details, but this is exactly what you do in your paper, I think.
So, Sasha, I have a question. So, presumably, well, what's governing the dynamics in these two? So, presumably, in the low power jet, the dynamics are governed by buoyancy, but you said you don't have gravity in there, so I don't understand how that would work. And then on the left hand side, presumably, these are essentially, you know, driven jets, dynamically driven jets. So, how does that work?
So, I'm still trying to understand what's going on these simulations. One clear difference here is that this jet rams into the ambient medium so fast that the material spills back. And that's what keeps the jet very, very straight. In this case, the jet rams much slower, so the spill back doesn't really happen. Whatever the jet deposits stays there and expands adiabatically. So that's the difference between these two. In this case, the jet is outrunning the head in the sense, or the plume that it produces. In this case, the plume is outrunning the jet. But I would have to work at that quantitatively in some simple spherical Kao model to try and understand what is the theoretically expected division between these two regimes. Does that answer your question?
Well, sort of. I'm just wondering what's governing, you know, what's making the move? Are these, you know, what's governing the dynamics? So if it's clear, you can't have, if you don't have gravity, you're not going to have buoyancy, right?
Yeah, so, there is no buoyancy in the simulations. That's right.
Right.
It's purely thermal expansion. What happens is that these jets deposit energy into the ambient medium, so the rotational energy of the central source gets converted into electromagnetic flux in the jet. That electromagnetic flux impinges on the ambient medium, slows down, reconnects, and heats up the ambient medium. And then whatever the heat that was deposited in the ambient medium, it's like a bomb, so it's going off continuously. And that bubble that you inflate expands adiabatically.
The last one, Avi? Yeah.
So let me re-ask that question in a very concrete sense. In the slides you showed at the very end, you showed this nice correlation between observed and implied magnetic flux on the black hole, or effectively jet power. What is the jet power? I'm assuming these are coming from measurements close to the core.
All of these measurements are coming from the core.
So then what is the inferred jet power for M87?
The inferred jet power is of order of accretion power, it turns out.
Do you have a number?
10 to the 40, let's see.
Can I find a number in the paper?
not in this paper, but in another paper, in this paper, you can find a number of the correlation. I'm not sure that there will be a number specifically for M87, but if something sits on this correlation, it means that the mass energy and flow rate into the black hole equals the energy flux through the jets. The energy efficiency of the jet production is 100%. So if M87 is sitting exactly on the correlation, which it will if we use the proper radiative efficiency of the disk, then I think it will be like 10 to the 44 arcs per second.
Question, but I think it's better to close and keep discussion going during the coffee break. So thank all the speakers during the session.